Joanne Harris, welcome to 20 Questions With.
Hello there.
Lovely to see you. You've written 20 novels. You've written 3 collections of short stories. You've written 3 cookbooks, or co-written. And you're probably most famous for Chocolat, which was turned into a movie with Johnny Depp and Juliette Binoche. But there's a lot to try and squeeze into 20 questions. I should also say, by the way, that you are a judge, have been a judge on quite a few literary prizes, literary awards, and you yourself are the recipient of multiple awards. I'm going to start just by asking you this. Why do novels matter?
I don't think it's just novels that matter. I think it is the process of making art, sharing art, finding points of connection. Novels do this, but so do stories, so does music, so do all kinds of other kinds of art. I think it is, at its very best, a sort of expression of shared humanity, and it is how we reach out to people and compare our experiences, and it's how we cross cultures and try to understand the past, try to imagine the future. It's something which is, I think, wired into the human experience to tell stories, to seek out stories, and via stories to understand the human condition, to understand our own internal mechanisms.
Are you always setting out to do the same thing when you start a novel?
Oh, I don't think I'm setting out to do anything when I start a novel. It's just sometimes it just feels like pulling on a piece of thread to see what's at the end of it, or solving a puzzle. You know, sometimes things will come out in the process, but it's very rare that I have a firm intention when I write a novel. It's really a question of peeling away the layers and trying to find the story and trying to find what it means to me and trying to express those things in a way that maybe other people will relate to.
Do you surprise yourself in the writing of your novels?
Always. I have no idea most of the time how a novel is going to end. Sometimes even when I'm quite close to the end, very often characters surprise me. Characters will do unpredictable, strange things that I didn't expect them to do that are not very convenient to the plot. And I have to try and roll with that and understand why they did that and why the story needed them to do that. So, yeah, a lot of it feels like quite a messy process for me. I'm not the same as all other writers. I think we all find our way into a story differently. Some writers are extremely precise in their plotting and they know what they're going to find at the end. I don't do it that way. I have a much more fluid approach to things because actually I like to be surprised, because I feel that if I'm surprised, then there is a chance that the reader will be surprised as well.
You must have written so many characters. Do some of those characters live on in you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think they all do, really, in a lot of ways. Some of them I have revisited, sometimes several times, and they don't just live on. They coexist alongside me, and sometimes I know what they're doing, and sometimes that comes into a story. And sometimes I'm fine to just let them go and to think, OK, that is the only story about you that I'll ever write. But, you know, it doesn't mean that it's over. I do have a sense that they've all gone off in different directions and that a lot of them are just having adventures that I'm not privy to.
Are you able to try to describe what it's like being you, in the sense that you clearly have an extraordinary imagination and your novels sort of weave in and out of different genres, don't they? I mean, you don't just stick to a particular genre. One novel might be described as one thing and another.
Yeah, I don't really understand this concept of genre at all. I don't buy into it. I don't tend to use it very often. And for me, it's not that important. I understand that other people find it useful, and that's fine. But I don't set out to go, aha, I am now going to write something in the mystery genre or the magic realism genre, because none of those terms mean anything to me.
And as far as living your own life is concerned, as far as your existence, your being you, clearly you haven't ever been anyone else. But do you feel like you live in your imagination perhaps more than some others might? Do you feel you live a lyrical existence in some sense? If I look at your social media, if I look at Twitter, X, there is a lyricism to that. I mean, the way that you describe the shed in your garden where you work, or the photographs you might take of the sky in its different stages. I suppose what I'm trying to get at is, do you have a very deep inner life between your novels?
It's an interesting question. And of course, as you know, I don't have a basis for comparison. I think people would think so. When I was a child, I was very prone to living in a fantasy world. And I was also able to see things that weren't there. I don't quite do that anymore, but I was aware as a child of having imaginary friends that I could see if I concentrated. And there were all kinds of other things that I could kind of, if I concentrated hard enough, I could sort of make them appear. And, you know, I used my imagination a lot to fill my world, but also to try to experience what it was like to be other people. So I would spend whole days being other people, practicing being fictional, if you like. And I was always very interested in stories, and I wanted to add to them and inhabit them and reenact them and reinvent them if they weren't satisfactory. And I think I still do this. I mean, it's difficult to explain, I suppose. But yeah, I've always had, I guess, what you would call a rich fantasy life in one way or another.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but your mother was French and your father was English.
That's right, yes.
Are they still alive?
Yes, they live about 5 minutes walk away from me.
So you were brought up by a French mum and an English father, and when she married your father, is it right that your mother only spoke French? She didn't speak English at that point?
Oh, that's right. Yes, she just announced that we were going to speak French at home. And given that she didn't speak English and that this was Barnsley and that there was quite a strong accent and that the English she had been taught at school just didn't cover any of the Yorkshire dialect she was surrounded by, it was just decided between them. My father is an excellent linguist and spoke very good French even then. And he just said, yes, all right, we will speak French. And so French was my first language. It was my brother's first language. It is still the language I speak to my parents in.
Is it the language that you think in and that you dream in?
This is an interesting question, because not all dreams are verbal, or at least in my case, not all dreams are verbal. Sometimes I dream in French, sometimes I dream in English. A lot of the time I'll dream in sound and scent and colour and tactile and kinetic energy as well. So all of these things kind of intersect. I tend to find that I'm more likely to dream in French when I'm in France. But that's not always the case either. I find most of my dreams, they're more likely to have music in them than they are to have words.
Music is important to you, and I'm sure we'll touch on that. But what's it like writing, as it were, in your second language? Because there are those who might assume that if someone is bilingual, they might not have the depth of relationship with either language. But you are, as I've said, a multi-award winning writer in English. And your first language growing up was French.
Yeah, I don't think of it as my second language anymore. Because I assimilated English very young, at a time when, you know, if you learn a language before you're about 6 or 7, then you don't learn it in the same way that you would in the kind of more academic context. And it becomes a more organic part of your language awareness. And so I don't think of it as something secondary to French. In fact, in a lot of ways, I would think my English is probably broader in vocabulary terms than my French, because having been brought up by two academics and all their friends were academics, most of the French I heard was academic French, which means that now when I go to France, I realise that there's a lot of very current slang that I'm just not privy to. And I do sound a bit old-fashioned, and occasionally people will comment on the fact that I use subjunctives in conversation, and they think that I must either be very posh or from the colonies somehow, which is very funny. But, you know, language isn't a kind of a unit that you inhabit or that you don't inhabit. There are kind of social intersections as well as academic and literary intersections, and that. So yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't even understand that I spoke two languages, because to me they'd come so naturally that I just thought that I spoke to certain people in one way and to other people in another way, and if they didn't understand, I just switched. So I didn't really have the concept of there being multiple languages in the world. There was just English and French, and then something nebulous that I called Welsh, because I didn't know anybody Welsh, and I just assumed that all the incomprehensible stuff was Welsh.
Have you thought about writing a novel in French?
Yes, but I don't think I ever will. I mean, for very prosaic reasons. One, it would be very difficult to publish that novel anywhere else but in France, because of the way the publishing industry in France works. And it's quite nice being published in dozens of countries if I write in English, but it wouldn't necessarily work that way in French. And also, I think that because my vocabulary and my French language is stuck in a certain time, there might be things that I wouldn't feel entirely at home writing about.
Is it true that you grew up above a sweet shop?
Yeah, I was. Yes, my grandparents had a sweet shop in Barnsley. My grandfather had been a miner, retired due to illness, having a lung problem that a lot of Barnsley miners had. And they retired to a sweet shop. And when my parents met, neither of them were employed. My dad was a student and my mother didn't know any English. And so, yeah, we lived above the shop for a time until I was about three. And then we moved out and my grandparents gave up the shop and got a house down the road. So my grandparents were very close to us.
Clearly, Chocolat was a massive moment for you, and its success as a film helped with your book sales. Have there been any disadvantages about writing a book that sold as many copies as Chocolat did? In other words, when an interviewer such as myself mentions it in their introduction, does that still make you proud that a book has been so famous, or does it mildly irritate you, or maybe both?
I think it's lovely that people still remember this book 25 years on. The fact that a book is still popular, that people still talk about it, that they have fondness for it, all of that is incredibly touching. And most of the time, I'm just really pleased that there's still this affection for those characters. Sometimes I'm a bit anxious that people who have centred the film over the book have a tendency to believe that my book was set in the 50s. And therefore that my other books are weird because they talk about modern things. And I keep trying to remind people that only the film was set in the 50s and my book was set in the present day. And the subsequent books are all set in real time following that present day. But, you know, this is the byproduct of having something that's an incredibly successful film. I was lucky in that I had, you know, a previously pretty much unknown and unacknowledged writing career because I was largely unread by anybody. And so it was kind of assumed that Chocolat was my first novel. It wasn't. I was very glad to be successful in my 30s rather than in my 20s because it gave me a little bit of breathing space. I was glad that I liked the film because I know a number of other authors who have had films made of their books who really hated the film and who felt that it put a crimp on their career. I don't think it did with me. I was lucky that the book was a bestseller before the film was made, because that way I could tell myself that, you know, it wasn't just because of the film that I got this exposure and these readers. So I think, you know, I've had a pretty good time. And also I've been lucky in that by and large, I don't have readers say to me, "We wish you'd write more things like Chocolat," because actually some of my current readers haven't even read Chocolat. They came to me via something else, via one of my myth punk books or one of my crime novels or something like that. So I've got this very diverse audience to match the kind of range of things that I write about, which is also great because, you know, no author can assume that 30 years into writing books, they're still going to be making a living.
Where did the importance of food come from in you?
Everyone eats, you know, everybody has a relationship with food. I think with me, it was partly to do with my dual heritage because I had influences from both sides of the family and they were both very different. And so I was very aware that food has a cultural significance and an emotional significance. And so I kind of ran with that because when I was writing Chocolat, it was Easter. I was still a teacher. We could see kind of Easter chocolates all over the place. And I took a school's trip to France and it reminded me of being a kid and seeing these Easter chocolates in shops and how different it was to England. And I started to think about feasting and fasting and the interesting kind of tension between those things within religious groups. And I thought, oh, this is, why don't I write a book about food? People don't generally set out to write books where food is as central as it was, or at least they didn't at the time. And it became a kind of exploration of all kinds of things with food as a handy kind of backdrop against them all.
When you cook yourself, Joanne, do you look forward to it? Do you get excited about it? Or do you drag your feet?
Well, I don't cook much, you know. I don't cook these lavish meals. It's very rare, unless I actually have friends over, which is not very often. I don't often cook for a lot of people. I tend to go for speed and quality rather than, you know, I just don't have time to spend hours in the kitchen reducing a bouillon or something. So usually what I cook is very simple. I write about food a lot better than I actually make it. And, you know, I think people might be disappointed if they saw most of the things that I cook because they're pretty basic.
If I throw some of the titles of your books at you, The Evil Seed, your first novel, Chocolat, of course, Blackberry Wine, The Strawberry Thief, Honeycomb, Maiden Mother Crone. Is there a book that you think best expressed what you were trying to do? I mean, that's another way maybe of saying that you're proudest of. Or maybe is there a difference between what you think of a book and what you think other people think of it?
Oh, always. There's always that distinction because, you know, what I experience when I'm writing a book isn't necessarily what somebody's going to experience reading it, nor should it be, actually. You know, I think that if you send a book out into the wild, it belongs to everybody who reads it. And it is up to them to draw their conclusions and to imagine the characters and to inhabit it in whatever way they want and to find in it whatever they need. And so I'm always surprised and rather moved at what people do find in these books, because sometimes they will fix on a particular component, which to me was quite minor, and to them is really important. I got a lovely email the other day from somebody in Switzerland who was saying that she was so happy with the way I'd depicted disability. And I had to think a bit about where I depicted disability. And what she meant was the little girl in The Strawberry Thief and also Vian's second daughter, Rosette, in the books after Chocolat. But I didn't set out to do that. And they were quite relatively minor characters. And I hadn't given as much thought as perhaps I should to how somebody who had experienced that kind of life might relate to those characters. And I was really happy that she felt that I'd done it right. But, you know, you can't know what people will find in books because they are kind of Rorschach tests. Everybody sees some element of themselves or their own experience. And sometimes it can be very different to the thing that I thought I set out to do.
We've already mentioned your shed. And I wonder whether writing somewhere outside of the four walls of your actual home is a help to you. And can you give us a sense of the process of you writing a novel, how you come to it, whether you're religious about timings and time of day, and whether the process of it actually is more enjoyable than it is tedious or intimidating? Just take us into your world of actually writing your books.
Well, if it was tedious or intimidating, I wouldn't do it because I'm very lazy and I would just avoid doing it. And it doesn't work like that for me. But it's not always the same process, depending on the book. Sometimes books are easier to write than other books, and sometimes they are more linear than other books. And sometimes I can get an idea which is nicely formed and I know what shape it's going to be. And sometimes I can just get a messy jumble of ideas and I have no idea what shape they're going to be, but I know they're going to have certain components. I don't tend to word count or think how many minutes I've spent writing because I don't think it's helpful. But I do try to write a little bit every day just to keep the book in the headspace and to make sure that I'm still thinking about it. Because to me, most of writing is a process that happens away from the computer, away from the desk. Much of it is a process of internalizing ideas and then trying to find ways of externalizing them again for the audience. And so a lot of my best writing happens when I'm driving around or going for a run or having a bath or, you know, anything at all. It doesn't have to be at a computer. But every book has its own energy. And one of the things that I've learned that I have to do is to try and get into that headspace as quickly as possible so as not to waste time. This happened, this started when I was a teacher where I didn't have any time to waste. And now it continues when I'm a full-time author and I have lots of other things coming in to take my time and I have a tendency to procrastinate. So getting into the headspace is really important, which is why I tweet about the shed, because I'm not obviously not always in the shed because I move around and I do different things and I do festivals and I travel. But I have to try and get into that shed space, if you like, to be able to create. And so one of the things that I do is I will tweet about the shed on Twitter, now X, now that Musk has messed it all up. And I will try to create a sort of image of what the shed is today. And it could be a rocket ship, it could be a flying carpet, it could be anything at all. This to me is my getting into the zone exercise. It doesn't take long. And it is a kind of trigger for me to start work. I've also found that I am very sensitive to scents. Because I have synesthesia and I tend to process the world in colours and scents anyway. But also because quite early on when I was a teenager, I read Stanislavski's book, An Actor Prepares, and figured that actually there are a lot of those techniques that are very portable in terms of writing characters. And one of his tricks is to assign a perfume to your character and to wear it to get into character. And I thought, oh, well, what if we could do this with books? It turns out that it works very well for me. And so I assign a scent to a book as I start it. And it means that, because scent to me is a kind of emotional trigger, it means that I don't have to spend ages getting into the zone because I associate the scent with the thing that I'm writing. And so it can be almost instantaneous. And in my little book, 10 Things About Writing, I had a whole chapter about getting into the zone. And that was one of the things that I said had worked for me.
Just explain synesthesia to us.
Well, I learned about this quite late. I realise now that I've had it all my life, but because you never compare your experience as a child to anybody else's experience, I just assumed that everybody could smell colours. For instance, your red top there smells of chocolate to me. I know there's no chocolate in the room because Easter has gone and we've eaten it all. So I know that it's the red thing that's triggering the scent of chocolate. And so I grew up thinking that everybody smelt chocolate when they saw the colour red, and that when I described something as the chocolate one and people looked at me in a funny way because they expected chocolate to be brown and I knew that it was red, you know, it was just they were at fault somehow. And then as I read various books and saw various things on TV, there was one particularly interesting show about synesthesia on TV about a man who tasted names. And I realised that, you know, I had some version of this. And it's a kind of neurological divergence, if you like, whereby the modules of the brain that are supposed to process sensory input, in the case of people with synesthesia, are kind of fused with each other so that it is possible to see music in colours or to see days of the week in terms of colours and shapes, or to associate certain words with physical sensations. And you know, there's all kinds of different variants because no two people have synesthesia in the same way. For me, it happens to be mostly colours and scents.
Tell us about the centrality of music to your life. And you've actually worked in music, haven't you? I think you've sort of participated in the creation of operas or mini operas.
Yes, I've been surrounded by musicians all my life. My grandfather was a very keen musician, my French grandfather. There was always classical music playing in my house. I learnt later on to appreciate other kinds of music. But I think also because I'm a linguist and that kind of tends to intersect with music. I was brought up with, you know, French poetry, for instance, which is very, very musical in tone and which is all based on something which is quite rhythmic and which has a musical interpretation to it. And so yeah, I learned to play musical instruments as a child, and I always wanted to play. And so I was always in bands. And when I was 16, I joined a band with my then boyfriend, who was the drummer, who we're still in the same band. I ended up marrying the drummer. And we wrote music together with our friend Paul, who plays the keyboards and composes most of the music. But I also think that it's very intuitive that words and music and stories and narratives should go together. I write a lot of work based on fairy stories and folk ballads. And when you look at the origins of folk stories and things like the child ballads, for instance, you realise the relationship between music and narrative and how important it is. And I just like the fact that stories don't like to stay on the page. They like to be expressed in different ways, either through music or through dance or through theatre or through film or through being read to. People are starting to like audiobooks a lot more now than they did 30 years ago, which is great because, you know, I was always read to as a child by my parents, by my grandparents. And that too has sort of fed my desire to take stories into different media.
And you have written operas, have you?
Yes, I wrote the book to an opera called Stunners, which Howard Goodall wrote the music to, and it just premiered heartbreakingly just before COVID, and then all our plans fell through. And so I'm trying now to resurrect it and take it back to the state at which it was then. But yes, I've written some little mini operas as well with a lovely young composer called Lucy Treacher, based on various fairy tales that I had written, and I wrote the lyrics to those things. And I also have this show called Storytime with my band, which we sometimes play at festivals, which is basically original music, original stories, projections on the screen, and some small element of theatre.
I know, Joanne, that we've talked about genre and how you are not, as it were, a prisoner of genre. But are you aware of literary rules? Are you interested in rules, if only perhaps so that you can break them, or break them knowing that you're breaking them? And are you a voracious reader? I mean, are you constantly reading other people's work and wondering how you might even improve yourself as an author? How self-conscious are you about all this stuff?
I'm self-conscious, but I am always reading, and I am always trying to do new and different things, because I think that, you know, there is no reason that we shouldn't always be improving and learning. I think it's essential to keep reading. I don't think that you can create art without inputting art, whether that is literary fiction, genre fiction, comics, games, music, pictures. I think, you know, the imagination needs to fire on something. And so I'm always reading. I can't imagine a time when I wouldn't be reading something. I know that some authors prefer not to read at all when they're writing a book, but given that I'm always writing a book, I would just have stopped reading 30 years ago, which would have been tragic. Also, I think aesthetics change. New generations have different requirements, different attention spans, different focus. I would like to keep learning. And so everything I write is, to me, it has to be some kind of a risk. There has to be some new element in there, because otherwise I would be going over the same ground, and I don't want to do that. I want to keep moving forward.
Did your years as a teacher, do you think, help you as an author?
I'm sure they did. I think one of the things that I found energizing about being a teacher was this human contact that I had on a daily basis. New situations emerging, new crises, new dramas. A school is a kind of stage for everything you can possibly imagine, tragedy, farce, everything in between. And there are all these individuals, all these people you're going to meet and interact with. And to me, that was really the heart of what I was trying to do. I was trying to write stories about people. So yes, it was important. For a long time, I swore to myself that I wouldn't write any books about teaching. And then, of course, I wrote some books about teaching, but I had to give myself a bit of space between the reality of that world and writing about it, because I often write with a slightly different and sometimes nostalgic perspective about things. And I don't tend to write about the world that I'm in right now. I tend to want to have a different view out of the window, if you like.
As a literary judge yourself, can you help us to understand the process of and the value in trying to rate creativity? Because the way we each experience a novel is very subjective, isn't it? So how do you decide that one novel is better than another?
Well, I think it's very difficult, because as you said, it's an absolutely subjective process. We can connect with something very strongly and somebody else can just feel nothing at all. And that's always a risk. I have mixed feelings about literary prizes. I think some of them are better than others. Some of them are more valuable than others. But I think that as a concept, literary prizes are generally important, because they can give visibility to people who might not have it. And they also centre literature in the public eye. And they say to people, books are important. This is why there's this prize. It's because we think books are important. I think there is a certain amount of snobbery around literary prizes, which I don't think is a good thing. And I would like to see less of, and I would like to see more different kinds of fiction win literary prizes. I would like to see less of a hard line between what is purported to be literary fiction and what's purported to be genre, because I actually think that that line is much less of a hard stop than most people think it is. I would like to see more young adult books centered in the public consciousness as being valuable and valid, because we hear people complaining endlessly about young people not reading books, but we also hear people complaining endlessly about how the books that young people read are no good. and it's not true, and it's not helpful.
Your success as an author has brought you fame. And of course, we live firmly, many of us, in the world of social media. And you have chosen to engage in social media. Can you explain to us your experience of being well known and your experience of entering the fray, as it were?
Well, when I first started on social media, it was different to what it is now. I've seen it emerge. When I first started writing, there wasn't any social media. And I've seen its importance grow. And again, I have mixed feelings about it. So it can be very useful. It can be very toxic and unhelpful. But it is also very much a reflection of people and their thoughts and their preoccupations and their fears and the things they want to talk about. I think at its best, social media is a really good way of connecting with people, of understanding different experiences that you're never going to have, of debunking some of the ridiculous myths about writing and writers that I've seen kicking around. And one of the reasons I stayed on Twitter is partly because I have been disseminating bits of writing advice, bits of information about the publishing industry, and trying to debunk some of the more unhelpful myths about what makes a writer, trying to debunk the idea that there are some special godlike people who are elevated to writerhood and everybody else is just a pleb who needs to keep it to themselves. I think it's at its best moments, it is a democratizing force and it's a force for good. Unfortunately, it's also a force for misinformation and toxicity and fear, which is less good. But, you know, people are people and the internet doesn't exist as an objective entity. It's a reflection of humanity. And that's why we see all these things in it.
I've asked you 20 questions, so this is going to have to be a bonus thought. Huh. As someone who grew up with two languages, even though you weren't aware that you were growing up with two languages, do you have a special relationship both with England and with France?
Oh, yes, definitely. When I was a kid, my mother used to describe me as being split down the middle, and one side was English and the other side was French. And we would have conversations about which side was which. And I do feel a little bit like that still. I feel that when I am speaking French or when I am in France, I am a slightly different person and I have slightly different focus. I think I'm more outgoing in French than I am in English. I think I'm more of an introvert in England. But also, I think I'm more creative in English, whereas my French side is definitely the side that cooks. So I have affection for both countries. I am able to view critically, very critically sometimes, the politics of both countries. But I feel at home in both places. On the other hand, I also feel like a foreigner in both places, which is objectively true, and is a strange part of my experience and my relationship with those two languages and those two cultures, because, you know, wherever I go, I'm always going to be at least half foreign.
Well, is it really objectively true? I mean, you were born in Britain. You've got a British passport. I don't know whether you've got a French passport as well, but you are British. You're British.
I have two passports. And yet, I am not quite French enough for the French to think of me as a French person. And, you know, certainly growing up in Barnsley, I was considered very foreign indeed.
Joanne Harris, thank you so much for answering my 20 questions.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.